Hey guys, this right here is going to be a bonus episode. Whenever I figure out subscriptions and stuff like that, this type of material might be wrapped up in like a paid subscription, maybe like $1 or something. It's just to kind of help offset some of the cost of the memberships that I have to upload this stuff. But yeah, it just might be like $1 or something. And this is just going to be bonus material, stuff that's going to be more in depth. If you're really like a cardiovascular nerd like me, then it'll be really in depth with CV. Or if you're a CV ICU nurse, then that the material that will be available for like subscription and stuff like that will be available. But this right here is going to be from a book that I got from a group of physicians out in Germany. They're an amazing company. I'm not endorsed and I am not sponsored by them. The name of the company is Compendium Medicine, and they make pocket guides that are designed for physicians and their specialty. And this one happens to be for neurologists. And this is just basically going to be assessment of a patient with neuro disorders along with the neurological disorders themselves. So with the assessment, we're talking about the objective assessment, labs, imaging, stuff like that. And then with the neuro disorders, we're talking about, MG or myasthenia gravis. We're looking at epilepsy, migraines, stroke, stuff like that. And so the big one that I want to talk about is stroke. There are four major types of stroke. Two of them are harped on pretty heavily in nursing school, and two of them are not talked about at all in nursing school. And if they are, it's just like a sentence and that's it. So, stroke number one is going to be your hemorrhagic stroke. That right there is, they're going to present with what they would call is the worst headache of their life, 20 out of 10 pain. And it is known as a thunderclap headache. Usually, the patient will be able to articulate themselves. There are no deficits. It's just an immense amount of pain because one of the vessels in the brain has now ruptured, and you're leaking brain into the brain, into the skull, and then you have that hypothesis. I can't remember the name of the hypothesis where it's basically one has to give that way the other one can grow. But because you're in that compartment, it's not, there's no give. So it's just a big pressure cooker in there in the skull. I think it's the Monroe Doctrine, I think is the name of it. That right there is your ischemic stroke. Your biggest contraindication is going to be tPA, TNK, or any type of blood thinner. And again, just think about the mechanism of action there. You're leaking blood into the brain. The last thing you want to do is thin it out, right? And make that bleeding easier. So that's your hemorrhagic stroke. Ischemic stroke is the one that we're all very familiar with. We're talking about right-sided deficits with the left-sided stroke, and then left-sided deficits with the right-sided stroke. Your biggest thing is going to be your TNK, tPA, within your window. If I'm not mistaken, it's like 4 hours or something like that. I can't remember right off the top of my head. I don't deal with it too often. But that is the window, I believe. Don't hold me to that. It might be 60 minutes. I'm not sure. Yeah, forgive me. But yes, that right there is your traditional stroke. Really nothing much to talk about with that. You just want to make sure that you get that TNK or tPA in as fast as possible, get them to CT. Now, there is a condition that that physicians want to have with an ischemic stroke most of the time, and that's going to be what we call permissive hypertension. It's basically where the patient's going to come in with a blood pressure that's going to be severely elevated. We're talking about like 220s over 120s, or basically 200s over 100s. You don't want to get too hypertensive. So you're talking about less than 250. Ideally, around the 220 area is kind of like your red line max. And that right there is basically to help the brain kind of reperfuse itself with the resources that it has available. The damaged tissue in the brain is going to be called a penumbra, and it is like a bullseye or a concentric circle. So basically, as you get closer and closer and closer to the center of that circle, that is going to be your necrotic tissue or your dead tissue that is completely unsalvageable. But as you start scaling back out of the concentric circle, that is when you start getting into your revivable brain tissue. And so the brain has that hypertension as a defense mechanism to keep the blood trapped in that general area. That way it can continuously use all of the resources that is in that blood trapped in there. So the last thing you want to do is go through and give them labetalol or something like that that's going to drop their blood pressure. And then if you do that, all you're going to do is take all the resources that the brain is trying to use to save the penumbra, and you're going to be leaking it out and shuttling it back to the body. And now you're left with a dry occlusion area where the brain is that now that area, that penumbra is going to die off, and it's going to be a huge necrotic area with severe deficits. So just remember permissive hypertension. You're talking about allowing the blood pressure to remain high until you're able to deal with the ischemia. Now, the two least common strokes, or the least talked about strokes, I should say, is going to be your cerebellar stroke and your brainstem stroke. Your cerebellar stroke is going to be your patient's going to present with a sudden loss of balance. They're not able to coordinate themselves. There's no balance. So the biggest thing is that they were walking all of a sudden, and then they lost their balance, started tripping over their feet, or they started rubbing up against the wall, or they just lost their balance. They're able to communicate. There are no deficits unless the ischemia is higher up in the brain. But typically, you're looking at just a loss of balance, a loss of coordination. That's when you are going to start with like the finger to nose test, or you're going to be assessing those cranial nerves for coordination and balance. And so that right there is your biggest takeaway for a cerebellar stroke, which is the loss of balance. Now, the one that I think is the most terrible is going to be your brainstem stroke. And if you think about the anatomy of the brain and how everything works, all your nerves and all your cranial nerves and stuff like that all bunch together at the brainstem. And then they kind of go out throughout the body. And so if you have ischemia in that area, then you're basically going to be have paralysis from the neck down. You're not going to be able to move anything. You're not going to be able to talk because your phonation has been taken away. The only thing you can do is move your eyes. You are technically still ANO times four, if that's the correct way of saying it. Like you know where you are, you know who you are, you know why you're there, obviously, and you know basically the year and time, but you just can't communicate. The only thing you can do is move your eyes. And they call that like entrapment syndrome or imprisonment syndrome or something like that. It's where you know you're there, you're just stuck in your own body, and there's nothing you can do about it. So that right there is going to be your brainstem stroke. And the biggest takeaway for that is going to be your paralysis from the neck down, along with lack of communication and phonation. So just a brief recap over all that. You have your ischemic stroke. That's the one that we're most familiar with, left and right sided deficits. You have the penumbra along with the permissive hypertension. You have your ischemic stroke, your hemorrhagic stroke. That right there is going to be your thunderclap headache, 20 out of 10 pain, worst headache of their life. Contraindications are going to be TNK, TPA, heparin, Lovenox, all that good stuff. And then you have your cerebellar stroke. That right there is just basically going to be a loss of balance. You're going to have your ANOs, but you're just lost your coordination. And it can progress to a much worse stroke if not treated right away. And then you have your brainstem stroke. That right there is where you're just trapped inside your own body and there's really nothing you can do. So I hope you guys enjoy this. This, again, is coming from the Compendium Medicine Company. It's a group of physicians out in Germany that create pocket guides for physicians in those particular specialties. Currently, they have mom baby, they have derm, they have acute medicine, first aid, cardiac, and neuro, along with radiology. They're coming out with the GIGU one here pretty soon. I pre-ordered, I'm still waiting for my copy. Super excited about it. Again, I'm not sponsored or endorsed by them. They're just a really good company that puts out great material. And yeah, if you guys are interested in their material, again, it's Compendium Medicine. Again, I'm not sponsored or endorsed by them. They're just a good company that puts out helpful material. So this particular information is coming strictly from that. It's strictly a bonus episode. I may or may not set up a subscription service for this stuff. But regardless, I hope you guys enjoy.
Oh boy, got some blood going.
Yeah, blood.
He's wearing it too.
Welcome to the bed. When you get over to the bed, we'll go ahead and give you the story. This is all going to happen super fast. Welcome to the emergency room.
70-year-old female, single driver of a vehicle. Appears that she went off-road into a ditch, rolled over her car onto a trailer, caved in. The top of the vehicle was caved in, and she was hanging out partially from the window.
She's been
for 45 minutes of CPR. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. So, if you're gearing up for a big med-surg exam, maybe feeling a bit overwhelmed by neurocritical care, well, you're not alone. It's a mountain of information.
It really is. And look, you just can't memorize everything. That's not the goal today. We've gone through a lot of material, TBI, stroke, infection, seizures, the heavy hitters.
Right. And we're taking the Pareto approach, you know, trying to find that critical 20%, the stuff that really matters, the red flags, what you do that gives you like 80% of what you need for exams and frankly, for handling these situations in acute care.
Exactly. We want this to be a practical review, focusing hard on the nursing side. What do you assess? What interventions are priority? What's truly need to know?
Okay, let's jump right in. Probably the scariest place to start. Traumatic brain injury and managing that dangerous rise in intracranial pressure.
Yeah, TBI. The first thing you're looking at is the GCS, the Glasgow Coma Scale. It sets the stage. Mild is 13 or higher.
But we're focusing on the tougher cases, right? Moderate, GCS, 9-12. And severe, which is anything 8 or below, those need immediate serious attention.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And while that initial impact, the coup contre coup injury, is significant, often the real danger comes later. It's the secondary injury cascade.
You mentioned the sources highlight torsional motion. Why is that specific mechanism, that twisting, so bad?
Because that twisting causes diffuse axonal injury, DAI. It's widespread damage to the axons themselves. It's often hard to treat surgically, and it's a major driver of swelling, edema, and ultimately herniation. That's the outcome we dread.
Herniation. So besides tracking the GCS, what's that absolute must-know sign that the brainstem is under critical pressure, the thing you see and just know it's an emergency?
Cushing's triad, no question. You have to spot it. It's those three things together. Really high blood pressure, often with a widening pulse pressure, or really slow heart rates of bradycardia, and then irregular breathing patterns, like chain Stokes breathing or just erratic breaths.
Okay. See that? Think herniation. Got it. Now, what about a specific injury type that shows up on exams a lot? The epidural hematoma, EDH, there's a classic story with that one.
Yes. The lucid interval. It's quite specific. The patient gets hit, maybe loses consciousness for a bit, then wakes up, seems okay, alert even, for minutes or hours.
And then crashes.
And then rapidly goes downhill. That's often arterial bleeding building up pressure fast. You'll see it as a convex shape on the CT. Clinically, it pushes things, causing the pupil on the same side to dilate and become unreactive, and weakness on the opposite side of the body.
That rapid decline means we have to manage ICP aggressively. What are the go-to meds?
Osmotic agents, primarily mannitol and sometimes hypertonic saline. Their job is simple: draw fluid out of the brain tissue into the blood vessels to lower that intracranial pressure.
And as the nurse giving these, you're watching kidney function, osmolarity?
Definitely both. These are powerful drugs, need careful monitoring of labs, urine output, and overall fluid status. It's a balancing act.
This whole situation screams teamwork, right? The doctors are diagnosing with CT, maybe MRI, neurosurgery is getting ready for potential surgery, like a craniectomy or burr holes. What's the nurse's core focus right then?
It's constant vigilance and preventing secondary injury. Following trauma protocols, yes, but mostly frequent neuro checks. GCS, pupil size, reaction, are they equal? Any asymmetry is a big warning.
Watching for Cushing's.
Absolutely. Watching for Cushing's triad. Interventions. Keep the airway open. make sure oxygenation is good. Positioning helps too, head of the bed elevated to help venous drainage, usually around 30 degrees unless contraindicated.
And talking to the family.
Yeah, that's crucial. Explaining that even if there was a lucid period, things can change very quickly. Managing their expectations and anxiety is part of it.
Okay, quick summary for TBI. Severe is GCS 8 or less. Cushing's triad means herniation is likely imminent. EDH has that classic lucid interval. Treatment focuses on lowering ICP with osmotics and potentially surgery. That feels like the core.
That's the high yield stuff, yeah.
All right, let's switch gears. From pressure to plumbing, vascular crisis specifically, acute ischemic stroke.
Right. Ischemic stroke, where a clot blocks blood flow. It's much more common than hemorrhagic stroke, maybe four times as common, often caused by atherosclerosis or emboli, maybe from AFib.
And the whole game here is about time, isn't it? Saving the ischemic penumbra. Can you explain that bit?
Sure. The penumbra is the area of brain tissue surrounding the core infarct, the part that's already dead. This penumbra tissue is struggling, it's ischemic, but it's potentially salvageable if we restore blood flow quickly enough.
Okay, so how do we measure the deficit and track changes? What's the tool?
The NIH Stroke Scale, or NIHSS. It's a standardized way to assess those sudden neurological problems, weakness, speech issues like aphasia, vision changes, vertigo. The pattern of deficits often points to which artery is blocked, like the MCA, the middle cerebral artery, often causing that contralateral weakness and facial droop.
And the big intervention, the clot buster, is IVRTPA, like alprazolam. But there's a strict deadline.
Extremely strict, 4.5 hours. That's the window from the time the symptoms started. You have to administer it within 4.5 hours, assuming no contraindications.
That's a tight window. It requires everyone, ED docs, nurses, radiology moving fast. What if they miss that window or it's a big clot?
Then mechanical thrombectomy might be an option. That's where interventional radiology goes in and physically removes the clot. The window for that is longer, potentially up to 6 hours or even 24 hours in select cases if advanced imaging shows there's still brain tissue to save.
Before any of that, though, before we even think about giving RTPA, what's the absolute first diagnostic step? The one thing every suspected stroke patient needs immediately?
A non-contrast CT scan of the head. Right away.
Why non-contrast?
To rule out bleeding. You cannot give a clot buster if the stroke is hemorrhagic caused by bleed. It would make it catastrophic. So CT first to confirm it's ischemic.
And the nurse's role in that time window?
Documenting the onset time, the last known normal time, is critical. That's often the deciding factor for RTPA eligibility. And then rapid transport to CT.
Okay, let's say the patient gets the RTPA. The clock is still ticking, but now the focus shifts to monitoring, right? What's the biggest worry?
Bleeding. Intracranial hemorrhage is the major complication after IVT. So you're doing frequent neurochecks, watching the NIHSS score closely for any worsening, and keeping blood pressure under tight control. It can't be too high.
Anything else intervention-wise?
Absolutely. Preventing aspiration. Stroke patients often have swallowing difficulties. Keep them NPO nothing by mouth until they've had a formal swallow evaluation. Aspiration pneumonia is a common and dangerous complication.
Right, so for ischemic stroke, time is critical. 4.5-hour window for IVT. Non-contrast CT first to rule out hemorrhage. Post-IVT, watch like a hawk for bleeding and prevent aspiration. That covers the key points.
That's the core workflow, yes. And of course, secondary prevention, later meds for BP, cholesterol, anticoagulants for AFib, rehab. But the acute phase is all about time and safety.
Okay, let's move from clots to critters. Critical CNS infection. Bacterial meningitis.
Yeah, this one is also incredibly time sensitive. A bacterial infection of the meninges, the lining around the brain and spinal cord, it can progress really fast and has high mortality if you don't jump on it.
How do the bacteria usually get there?
Either through the bloodstream hematogenous spread or sometimes directly, like from a severe ear infection or sinusitis spreading inwards. Common culprits are Neisseria meningitidis meningococcus and Streptococcus pneumonia pneumococcus.
And the signs we need to recognize immediately. The classic ones.
The classic triad is high fever, a really bad headache, and neutral rigidity, stiff neck. That neck stiffness is a key sign of meningeal irritation.
But it's not always that clear cut, is it? What else might we see?
You might see confusion, vomiting, sensitivity to light, photophobia. And specifically with meningococcal meningitis, you look for a petechial or purpuric rash, tiny red or purple spots.
That rash sounds serious.
It is. It's a sign of bleeding under the skin, potentially indicating sepsis. There's the glass test. Press a clear glass against the rash. If the spots don't disappear under pressure, that's a medical emergency. We also check for Koenig's and Brudzinski signs, other indicators of meningeal irritation.
Okay, suspicion is high. What's the immediate nursing action? And there's a specific drug sequence here that's important, right?
Yes. First, if you suspect meningococcal meningitis, initiate droplet precautions immediately. Protect yourself and others. Then, IV access. And here's the key medication point. 4-V-dexamethasone, a steroid. It needs to be given before or at the same time as the first dose of IV antibiotics, especially if pneumococcal meningitis is suspected.
Why the steroid first? What does that do?
It helps reduce the inflammation caused when the antibiotics start killing the bacteria. When bacterialize, they release inflammatory stuff. The steroid helps dampen that response, which can decrease mortality and neurological complications like hearing loss, particularly with pneumococcal meningitis.
Got it. Steroids first, then antibiotics. Now, diagnosis often involves a lumbar puncture, an LP, to analyze the cerebrospinal fluid. What would we expect to see in bacterial meningitis?
Typically, the CSF pressure will be high, the fluid might look cloudy or purulent, glucose level will be low because the bacteria eat it, and the protein level will be high.
But doing an LP can be risky if the pressure inside the head is already really high, right?
Exactly. That's the major safety concern. If the patient has signs of significantly increased ICP, like a new seizure, changes in pupil size or reactivity, especially affecting cranial nerves to erysich, or a sudden drop in consciousness, you need a CT scan before the LP.
Why?
Because if there's high pressure and maybe a mass effect, sticking a needle in the lumbar space could cause the pressure gradient to shift suddenly and lead to brain herniation, fatal herniation.
So CT first if there are any red flags for high ICP.
Okay, so for meningitis, isolate quickly if needed. Give IV dexamethasone before antibiotics, watch for signs of high ICP, and get a CT before LP if those signs are present. CSF analysis confirms it. That sequence is vital.
Absolutely vital. And don't forget, bacterial meningitis is often a reportable disease, and close contacts might need prophylactic antibiotics if it's meningococcal.
Good point. Okay, final acute scenario, status epilepticus, the seizure that won't stop.
Right. Defined now as a seizure lasting more than 5 minutes, or if someone has multiple seizures back to back without regaining consciousness in between, it's a true neurological emergency. Why the 5 minute mark? It used to be longer, didn't it?
It did. They shortened it because we realized that prolonged seizure activity itself causes brain injury. The metabolic demand is huge. It can lead to brain swelling, lack of oxygen.
And the immediate physical risks?
Big ones are aspiration inhaling stomach contents leading to pneumonia, and also cardiac stress, like arrhythmias, plus physical injuries from the convulsions themselves. So stopping the seizure quickly is paramount.
Which leads us to the medication protocol. It's very stepwise, very testable. Can you walk us through it?
Sure. Once a seizure hits that 5 minute mark, it's go time. Step one, give a benzodiazepine the fourth, usually lorazepam or midazolam. These work fast to stop the seizure activity.
Okay, benzos first. What if that doesn't work?
Step two, if the seizure is still going after another, say, 5 minutes or so, you typically repeat the benzodiazepine dose.
And if that fails? If it's refractory?
Step three. Then you move quickly to a second-line agent, a different type of anti-seizure medication, given IV at a loading dose. Common choices are phenytoin, levetiracetam, or valproic acid. These provide more sustained seizure control.
That sequence, benzos, repeat benzos, then a different IV anti-seizure med, is critical. The nurse's role seems huge here. Timing, IV access.
Absolutely. Accurate timing of the seizure start is job one. Ensuring you have good IV access before you desperately need it, and then administering those meds rapidly according to protocol. Meanwhile, respiratory therapy might be helping with airway support, which is crucial.
And safety during the seizure.
Basic seizure precautions. Protect the head. Clear the area, maybe padded side rails if they're in bed. Don't restrain them forcefully, but protect them from injury. Monitor oxygen saturation closely. Airway, breathing, safety.
What happens if even those step three meds don't work?
Then the patient likely needs ICU level care. Continuous EEG monitoring to see if seizure activity is ongoing, even if convulsions stop. They might require general anesthesia with drugs like propofol or barbiturates to induce a coma and break the cycle.
Wow, okay. And after it finally stops, the postictal phase, what are we focused on then?
The patient will likely be confused, very drowsy, maybe weak on one side temporarily. This is called Todd's paresis. Monitor their recovery. And then education is key. Mm-hmm. Helping the patient and family understand triggers like missed medications, alcohol withdrawal, lack of sleep, high stress to prevent future episodes.
So summarizing status epilepticus, time it accurately, over 5 minutes is SE. Follow the sequence, benzos first, repeat if needed, then a second line high V ASM. Prioritize airway, breathing, and safety throughout. That's the crux of it.
That really nails the acute management priorities.
Okay, so we've hit TBI, stroke, meningitis, and status epilepticus, these high acuity emergencies. If you can really get down the timing for stroke, the drug sequences like dexamethasone before antibiotics or the benzo-first approach for SE, and those critical warning signs like Cushing's triad or a lucid interval, you've really got a handle on the core high-yield information.
Definitely. Those patterns and priorities are what save lives and what show up on exams.
Yeah.
And, you know, we talked a lot about acute increases in intracranial pressure today.
Yeah, it's a common thread in TBI and meningitis.
Right. But it makes you think about the other end of the spectrum. What about conditions with chronic high ICP or issues related to CSF drainage, like hydrocephalus? How does that challenge assessment, especially in older adults?
That's a great point. We focused on the emergencies, but chronic ICP issues can be subtle. You're thinking about normal pressure hydrocephalus.
Exactly. Think about an elderly patient. They might have some memory issues, maybe some urinary incontinence. Maybe they're walking a bit funny, shuffling gait. Could be dismissed as just getting old or dementia.
But there's a specific pattern to look for, isn't there?
There is. Hakim's triad. It's that specific combination. The cognitive impairment, which can be reversible, urinary incontinence, and gait disturbance. Mm. If you see those three things together in an older patient.
You should think NPH, normal pressure hydrocephalus, which is potentially treatable, often with shunting.
Precisely. It's a reminder that even outside these acute crises, understanding ICP dynamics and recognizing those key clinical patterns, like Hakim's triad, is crucial for good nursing assessment and catching potentially reversible conditions.
A really important final thought. Spotting those patterns, acute or chronic, makes all the difference.
It really does.
Well, that's the essential knowledge we aim to cover today. Hope this deep dive helps you nail those neuro questions. Thanks for joining us. Study smart, and we'll see you next time.